We are what we eat, but surprisingly we take the fact of food being available and its character too much for granted. Every one of us owes a debt to our farmers, the men and women who ensure food is on our tables every single day and underwrite its quality. But farming is no romantic idyll, an imagined world of farmers delighting in beautiful fields, meadows and hills while they bring us our food. It's a tough, hard business for all its fundamental importance. There's a dissonance gap between what we see on the supermarket shelves and all that lies behind them. Here, to bridge that gap, is Minette Batters, president of the National Farmers Union of England and Wales, with an estimated 50,000 members. Minette has changed the course of history, the first woman to become president of the NFU and to be re-elected 3 times. Outside of this role, she runs a tenanted family farm in Wiltshire. Her focus has always been to leave her farm in a better state than when she found it, and that's what she's aiming to do at the NFU as well. But there's been a handful of pretty tough hurdles in her way. Brexit, COVID, the recent energy crisis, not to mention the need to balance sustainability with farmers' profit margins. Farming, she says, should not be seen as an obstacle to the drive to net zero, but rather part of the solution. But what are the pressures? How is our relationship with food changing? Should Britain be more self-sufficient in food? And if so, how? How will British farming be faring in just a decade's time? And as social scientists, what about the rural economy and rural society? Well, here were the answers is Minette Batters. It's great you've been able to find the time for us. Thank you so much. Let's plunge into this. Here you are, a very effective spokeswoman for farming. I think you've kind of delivered significant change, and you've actually kind of helped the British public see farming through farmers' eyes. You know, when you look back over the last kind of 6-8 years, what do you think is your greatest achievement?
Oh, gosh, it's hard to, I guess, put that into words, really, because there have been many achievements, which are sort of obvious. So for the Prime Minister now, don't forget, I've worked with 3 different ones in the last 12 months. For
quite something, that, isn't it?
Quite something. But for this one to put in writing, you know, after the food security summit that we'd called for, not now, not ever will we import hormone-treated beef or chlorine-washed chicken, felt quite seismic. Had I been told that back in 2020 when we led our standards campaign and we had over 1 million people that signed up to it, had we been told that then by Boris Johnson, I would have thought it was the biggest win we'd ever had. 3 years down the line, it sort of seems quite obvious that you would say that. So
that's going to be a big obstacle if we have to do a trade deal or want to do a trade deal with, say, the Americans. I mean, because a lot of that food is, you know, hormone-treated, chlorine-treated, chlorine-washed chickens, famously. I mean, so that is a win.
I think, in all honesty, without that campaign that 1 million people supported, we had chefs, we had farming organisations, we had environmentalists, we had animal welfare experts. Without all of them coming together and having that campaign, I actually think we probably would already have imported hormone-treated beef or chlorine-washed chicken. So it made a big difference. Things never go as far, of course, as you want them to go. At the end of the day, a government is all-powerful. And we gave a lot of things away in trade deals. But that was, I think, a considerable success that, you know, we have undermined our standards, but we could have done it, you know, a lot worse than what we have done to date.
Let's just spend a few seconds getting into the minutiae of that campaign. Is it just gathering a petition? Is it just, I mean, what were the pinch points? How did you identify how to make that effective? Did you know before you began, there's a lot of public sympathy for the stance you were taking, and how did you magnify it? I mean, just give us a sense of your thinking.
I'd been elected for my second term, and within 2 weeks, we'd gone into lockdown. So we were faced with this huge threat of trade deals, particularly a UK-USA free trade agreement. And we were stuck on our farms. We couldn't go out and meet people, see people. And we had the beginnings of a standards campaign from the previous autumn that had 27,000 people signed up to it. We knew that if we were going to affect change with government, we had to get a lot of people. And we effectively had to have a newspaper that would resonate with a lot of people. Now, I remember writing an email to the Mail and saying, you know, we're having the standards campaign, will you work with us? And actually Ted Verity from the Mail on Sunday agreed to. And so for quite a few months, we were able to put people forwards. Jamie Oliver wrote an open letter to Boris Johnson. Nicholas Soames wrote a piece. I wrote several pieces. And gradually the numbers ticked up. And the call to arms was, you know, we don't want food imported into this country that would be illegal for our farmers to produce here. And for the first time ever, it brought chefs, it brought farmer groups, it brought environmentalists, consumer groups, brought them all together to say this cannot happen. That was unique. And the British people responded to it in a very short space of time. So within under 3 months, we had over 1 million people sign up. And it was one of the most successful petitions of modern times. And I think is solely responsible for the fact that we are not importing hormone-treated beef or chlorine-washed chicken. And the Prime Minister has put it in writing that we won't be. Not now, not ever.
Well, hats off to you. I mean, nutrition and what we eat is so kind of fundamental. I mean, the Brits are one of the most obese in Europe with all the threats that means to diabetes. We have the shortest five-year-olds in Europe because of poor nutrition. There's not enough fresh food. There's not enough high-quality food at scale that's affordable. Put these pieces together for us. I mean, how can you, as a spokesperson for farmers, when you hear me put those things on the table, what's your reaction?
I suppose what I represent in representing farmers across England and Wales is people who produce raw ingredients. And we produce incredible raw ingredients, and we have an amazing climate here to be able to produce really high quality fruit and vegetables. The diet of the nation, and something I feel passionately about, you know, has to start with education. We don't have food on the national curriculum anymore. We don't teach our children how to cook. And if I look at other countries, you know, in Germany, your classroom is outside and you are really working within the natural environment to understand the basic STEM skills. A lot of people learn through a vocational lens. So absolutely, by understanding how things are growing in the soil, it's brought, I guess, a practical level of learning to the role of STEM learning rather than just on a screen. It's made it real, which a lot of children, in particularly in primary, have really responded well to. So we'd like to see agriculture as part of STEM learning.
I have to say, I've been working on a book and I found myself reading a book written before the Second World War by Harold Macmillan, a former Prime Minister. He wrote a book called The Middle Way. He's a Tory, an old Etonian. And he was calling in 1938 for a National Nutritions Board. He wanted every local authority to be required by central government to make sure that every family in their purview ate a quota of calories that were balanced every day between protein, carbohydrates and all the rest of it. That is, I mean, it's unbelievable when you read it. And Henry Dimbleby saying something similar to a government review and getting a raspberry from the government for his efforts. When are we going to get to a point where we actually take what we eat as seriously as we should be? We're talking about it for nearly 100 years.
You go back to the period of Macmillan. I mean, it's extraordinary how we have embraced and abandoned the importance of producing food. You know, you go back to the Great Depression, the repeal of the Corn Laws. You know, the last Agricultural Act in 1947, you know, we'd faced rationing. We were 30% self-sufficient. And that drew a line in the sand and said, we must never be in this place again. And we went to the 1980s, a relatively short period of time, to over 80% self-sufficient. We're now about 60% self-sufficient, but we face another period potentially of abandonment whereby we say, it doesn't matter how much food we're producing here. The line is, we're a wealthy nation, we can import it. Now, we faced rationing of eggs last autumn, we faced rationing of salads this year. And I would say that we absolutely need to be producing more of what we're good at here.
You sound like you're not an advocate of the complete free market. It sounds to me as though if you want to be self-sufficient, I mean, the state has to do stuff to make that happen. And it has to work with social partners to make that happen, one of which is the National Farmers Union. I mean, am I putting words in your mouth?
What we've called for is the environment and food production to be treated as one in the same thing, effectively. Now, we've legislated targets, and rightly so, on the environment. We have nothing. We have no targets for food production at all. We have targets for house building. We have targets for green energy. We have targets for tree planting. The fundamental duty of a government to feed its nation, and we have no statutory target for it. You know, it's the largest manufacturing sector. Why would we want the largest manufacturing sector to be reliant on imports to be producing our manufactured goods here? We should be really focusing on what we produce here and adding value to it within our manufacturing. That's good for the economy. That's good for jobs. That's good for growth. And it I think, gives us a real chance to lead the journey to net zero and how we get to a world of carbon neutral food production. That's a massive role for a future government.
What about decarbonising agricultural production? I mean, one of the kind of great jokes is that it's cattle that produce most methane, or a considerable part of the methane in the atmosphere. So don't eat meat. What's the kind of battering ram for decarbonising agriculture? What's the thing above anything else that we should be doing?
So how we produce our meat across the world is incredibly variable. Now, here in the UK, we don't have massive feedlot systems of 70, 100,000 head of cattle kept on a very small yarded area of land and fed grain. So that, there is no doubt, is causing emissions. And if we look at a dairy as an example, if globally all cows were like a UK dairy cow, we'd need nearly half the number of cows that we've got. So we have half the global average of emissions here in the UK. So it's been a great success story. That doesn't mean to say there isn't more that can be done. And, you know, we, back in 2018, we said that agriculture could hit net zero by 2040, could beat the government's target with the right policies, the right incentives in place. Now, at the moment, the right policies and incentives aren't in place, and we're in a slightly uncharted territory as to what the journey to net zero is. But it will really pitch farmers again as the solution in all of this. Indeed, we can't deal with climate change unless we work with our farmers, because if you look at the UK, 70% of it is a farmed landscape.
Fascinating. I mean, you don't normally think about farmers as notably progressive, actually. I mean, you don't think about, as they've done it heretofore, they're going to do it in the future, rather than kind of the newfangled ideas from that London office of the National Farmers Union. You know, I mean, do you find you get any pushback, or do you find that the farming community is kind of on your side? You've been re-elected 3 times, so I'm guessing they are on your side.
I think there's always a fine line in any membership organisation of representing your members, because at the end of the day, you know, they invest in you, they believe in me. But this is a time when there has been no playbook for what we're going into. You know, we are out of the Common Agricultural Policy. We were designing a whole new scheme.
Do you mourn that, or do you just say, let's just get on with it? I mean, we're out, so we just make the best of it. What's your...
I think there are challenges there. I mean, I took a Remain position, a public Remain position, on the back of the very little information that we had on what leaving would mean. I felt that agriculture's best interests were remaining until we had more information. But ultimately, we live in a democracy. We had a referendum. Whether you believe in that or not is another matter. But we had a referendum and people voted out. But, you know, we've seen through the journey that we've been on, you know, this is my fourth prime minister that I'm working with since I've been president of the NFU. And we've seen very different approaches. And our relationship with Europe is still not fully resolved. It's a lot more resolved than it was. But we've seen that it's not just as simple as leaving. Leaving is still not fully finalised.
I just want to take a moment to talk to you very briefly about the organisation behind the WE Society. The Academy of Social Sciences is a national body for academics, practitioners and learned societies in the social sciences. As the president of the Academy, I can tell you that we champion the vital role social sciences play in education, in government, in business, the list goes on. You can find out more about the Academy of Social Sciences work, support us, or read up on our fellows by going to the website acss.org.uk. That's acss.org.uk. Tell us what we should be covering, who we should be speaking to, by emailing wesociety@acss.org.uk. Now, back to the conversation. Give me a sense of the day-to-day life of farming, a farmer. I mean, there's two views abroad. I mean, one is that if the biggest, shiniest tractors will be in the farmer's yard. He'll drive the most lavish Land Rover, and he lives off high off the hog. That's one view of farming. And another view of farming is they've got their backs against the wall, and it's really, people are leaving the land, and it's impossible. I mean, what are we meant to think?
So I think producing food, whether you are an arable farmer producing grain and cereals and oil seeds, whether you are growing potatoes, whether you are like me, a livestock farmer, you never know what is going to happen. So last summer, we had a very, very dry summer. Drying costs were very low. Yields on the whole were good. Prices were up. And it was a very good harvest. This summer, it has rained for most of it. Quality is much lower. Costs have been much higher because cost inflation was already very high on the back of the war in Ukraine. There's a lot of drying had to go on. When you have a wet summer, that affects quality, that affects yield. So there are always challenges because effectively your office is outside. So if you've got an office that's outside, it doesn't make much difference what you're producing. You are facing the elements of the weather. And so there is no land, I think, of complete milk and honey. There are troughs of when things are going well and when things are not. And you're always saving for that rainy day, I would say, in farming. You're having to look long term and plan ahead for whatever may be thrown at you.
There's a sense, though, that in the food chain, the farmers are, they're kind of least affluent on balance, despite all the talk about the huge combine harvesters and all the rest of it. They are the least affluent. And actually, it's the big retailers that make the lush margins. They squeeze farmers on everything. You as a Wiltshire farmer with whatever it is, 300 head, I mean, you are a kind of piece of sand on the beach compared with these big players.
So it's a really difficult one, this, to resolve, because we have the most affordable food in the world, really. You have the US that has the most affordable per income spend. Then you have Singapore that, let's face it, doesn't really produce any of its food. Then you have the UK. So we have the most affordable food in Europe.
I hadn't heard that before, and I'm sure my listeners hadn't heard that. So we have the most affordable food in the world, with only the Singapore and the United States more cheaper and affordable than us. That's an extraordinary figure. Where's that data come from?
So that data is easily accessible. That's per income spend. So if we look back to the 1970s, 1980s, we used to spend sort of about 25, 30% of our earned income on our food. Now we spend less than 10% of our income on our food. It's been a huge success story, if you like, because whatever budget you are on, you've got access, and rightly so, to high quality, affordable British food. But what we are seeing now, I think, is a real tipping point with the value that comes back to the farm gate. And if we take eggs as an example, we last year saw 1 billion less eggs for sale in retail compared to the same time back in 2019. And a lot of that was because of the price, effectively, of those inputs. So the price of grain went up to sort of £300 a ton, heating for poultry sheds, electricity, wages, all of it was driving ever higher cost of production of producing those eggs. So, of course, the farmer, much the same if whatever you're producing, you can't continue to produce it at a loss. At some point, you will say, I can't keep putting working capital into this. I'm going to contract. The pig herd is smaller than it was before, because if you remember, we didn't have enough butchers here. We lost access into the Chinese market. So that national pig herd is much smaller than it was. And then For the growers, we've seen a lot more fresh, a lot less fresh produce produced here as well. So all of these things need action taken, and really all of it comes from having a comprehensive food strategy whereby you say our self-sufficiency matters. We do not want to have less production in these sectors. We want to be able to work with those farmers to produce the same amount or produce more.
There's also, I mean, a big story about who owns the land. I mean, half of it is owned by landlords and half our farmers kind of paying rent to landlords. So you've got all kinds of power structures in here. Now, if we're devising a research program or we're devising things that you'd love to know more about, what would they be?
So a constant criticism of mine when, you know, we have policies that are, for instance, about taking land out of production. So saying, well, we've decided we're not going to produce food there anymore. We're going to grow an environmental crop. And some landowners are taking land back in hand to get the value of public investment for them to grow those environmental crops. What I continually say is, what about the tenants? We must have a policy that has equal rights for landowners and tenants. Otherwise, we will just remove those tenants from the land. And we're seeing it, sadly, playing out in real time right now. And about 50% of the farmers in this country are tenant farmers. They don't own the land that they are on. And we've got to make sure that this is a fair approach to the future.
What would be a fair deal? I mean, five-year tenancy agreements, 10-year tenancy agreements. What would be a fair deal? What kind of package are you looking for?
Well, it's in the landowner and the tenant's best interest to have a good working relationship. So you want a long-term, as longer-term tenure as you can have, really. We've had in the past what has been called Agricultural Holding Act tenancies. Those have been three-generational. So you would have had a grandparent, a son, daughter, and then their son, daughter. So three generations spanning a very long period of time. Those sorts of tenancies are coming to an end. And on the whole now, a tenancy like I have is what's called a farm business tenancy. Ideally, those are good, but you want to see an option to renew built in. And as I say, you know, I'm a tenant farmer. I have a great relationship with my landlord and it's in the interests of both. But we've got to be safeguarding those tenants that potentially don't have that good relationship and making sure, you know, that they do have access to maintaining their farming business, which is their home, don't forget, as well.
What's it going to look like when we're driving through kind of the English, Welsh, Scottish countryside in the future? I mean, we cherish our fields and our hedgerows. I mean, is it going to get more factory farming? Are we going to see land taken out of use? Are we going to, you know, what's England going to look like in a decade's time?
So I think it's sort of still up for debate, really. And I think the British people love the fact that we have a sort of patchwork farming approach across the country that, yeah, there are big farmers, there are small farmers, there are tenant farmers, there are owner-occupiers. But it's been like that for a very, very long time. And I think now there is a new buyer of land. You know, the challenge of the voluntary carbon market has meant that carbon credits potentially are becoming more valuable than producing our food. So there are new investors in land and they are not necessarily focused on producing food. They're focused on the value that is in the carbon sequestered within the soil.
I know of a big solar farm planned in North Oxfordshire, which the uproar kind of locally about it is extraordinary.
I think ideally what we'd like to see is a lot more solar on our rooftops, on our farms. We could have individual turbines, small turbines on farms, whereby that farm could be totally self-sufficient in green energy. But equally importantly, it could be exporting into a grid. Now, the challenge at the moment is the grid is a national grid. And in many cases, farming businesses can't export excess electricity into that grid. So we'd like to see a grid whereby we have a local approach. We can export. You could then create totally sustainable rural communities that farming could supply their green energy. That would be a massive success story.
How are you responding to the fact that so many people are vegan nowadays? I mean, it's what, 2%, 3% of our population are vegan and it's growing exponentially. I mean, it'll be 5% in 5 years' time. 10% by the mid-2030s. I mean,
well, actually, what we're getting back is that it's not growing. You know, obviously, if people decide to have a vegan diet, that is entirely their choice. But all the evidence from health professionals now is that meat and dairy is a vital part of a healthy, balanced diet. Now, I think there's a big case to be made, and being made much more now, that we are eating far, far too much heavily processed food, whereby we don't know exactly what is in it. And indeed, a lot of vegan products are highly processed and have a lot of other ingredients to make them tasty. So for us, it's about producing sustainable meat and dairy and sustainable plant. So often it's sort of framed that plant-based is better. You can have unsustainable plant-based. And, you know, I don't think it does due justice, really, to the challenges of climate change. And we should be very proud here. I mean, my advice would be if you want to tackle climate change, you buy local, you buy British, you recognise that, you know, food miles add to the challenges of climate change. But I think it's widely recognised now that going vegan does not help the agenda. You want to select your meat carefully, know where it comes from. And food miles matter.
To round off, I mean, here we are. It's been a fascinating conversation. I've learnt things I didn't know. Not hard. But what's your injunction? What's your rallying call? Mm. You want us to kind of eat British meat and dairy. You want us to respect the fact that they, as I said to you, your little grain of sand on the beach when you think these massive agri-producers around that dominate world food. Is that your message? What's your message?
I trained as a chef and I feel absolutely passionately about food, about our ability to cook high-quality, nutritious food that maybe we've lost the art of really valuing what sitting around a table and enjoying a family meal is all about. And so every time I go into a shop, every time I go into a retailer, whether that's Tesco's or Sainsbury's or Aldi, I'm amazed at what we have on offer. And I guess it's really a question of appreciating what we're buying. You know, we're self-sufficient now in strawberries. From March until November, you can buy British strawberries. That's incredible, actually, I think. And you look at them.
But I'm a buyer. I'm an eater of them.
And the same with raspberries, with blueberries.
Both are pretty guilty on both cracks, yeah.
So my first message is, wherever you can, try and buy British and try and buy seasonal. Because seasonality is really important to taste and nutrition. You know, if you buy asparagus that's in season, that's been produced in Britain, I defy you to buy any better asparagus anywhere in the world than you can get it here. And the same and the same with other things. But seasonality.
British social scientists to buy British asparagus. Well, that's a first for social science.
But it's, well, that is about connecting you with what you're eating. And I think if we can connect people more with what they're eating, the seasonality, the nutritional benefits of what we're eating, then we're going to value our food more. We're investing in our bodies. There is nothing more important than what we feed ourselves with. And if we value it more, we'll stop wasting it as much. And then we will value our environment that we all are reliant on. I guess that's the message that I really want to land. Value what you're eating, invest in what you're eating, and recognise the people that produce it. Because without them, we wouldn't have any food here at all.
Anyway, look, it's been a fascinating conversation. I mean, you've launched a campaign, one of the most successful campaigns in the last decade. We're not going to have chlorine-washed chicken and we're not going to have hormone-modified beef on our table anytime soon. You've spelt out what it means to be a farmer. You've spelt out how cheap and efficient British food is. You've also outlined that it's all very well leaving the European Union and the Common Agricultural Policy. But if you want us to carry on and putting the food on the table of the same quality that we've been doing it while we were in the European Union, well, you better make good the deficiencies that there currently are where we're, because it's a halfway house and it isn't good enough. And you've been passionate about the way I began this. We are what we eat. Thank you. Thank you so much, Minette. It's been great talking to you.
Thank you for having me. It's been great talking to you too.
The We Society is brought to you by the Academy of Social Sciences. Find out more about the Society by going to www.acss.org.uk. I'm Will Hutton, the producer is Emily Finch, and it's a Whistledown production. If you haven't already, please subscribe to the podcast so you're the first to know when a new episode comes out.